When a body turns up in a community, dumped like garbage in a ravine or on the side of the road, everyone understandably wants to identify the perpetrator right away. When two more bodies turn up just 2 months later, it's clear that a serial killer is on the loose, and investigators kick it into overdrive to try to stop them before they strike again. Sometimes, though, despite using every tool in their arsenal, a suspect can't be identified and the case goes cold until new technology is developed that can finally give everyone the answers they've been looking for. This is Monsters. On July 17, 1973, the body of a young woman was found lying in the water at the bottom of a culvert. Her identity was revealed to be that of 16-year-old Sandra Newton, and a medical examination determined that she had been sexually assaulted and strangled to death with her own skirt. On Saturday, July 14, Sandra had been out at a nightclub in Britain Ferry, just north of Port Talbot in Wales. She had spent the evening with her boyfriend, and the couple walked to a secluded area where they engaged in sexual activity. From there, they walked to where the boyfriend was staying, and after that, Sandra began walking home alone. It's unclear if she was actively hitchhiking or if someone just pulled up and offered her a ride, but she was never seen alive again. The investigation into Sandra's murder had a suspect right away. Of course, her boyfriend was immediately questioned about her murder, as murders are generally carried out by someone close to the victim. Also, the location of the culvert was so well hidden that investigators were sure the perpetrator would have had to have been local to the area. On top of that, her boyfriend was also married and he was having an affair. Of course, if Sandra had threatened to tell the man's wife about the affair, he may have killed her in a fit of rage. Investigators weren't able to find any evidence to link him to the crime, and it was revealed that he didn't own a car or even have a driver's license, so it was unlikely he would have been able to transport the body to where it was found. The police remained suspicious, but the boyfriend was not pursued. On September 16, 1973, a retired man was walking his dog in the woods in Landarcy in Wales. As he walked through the forest, he saw what he thought might have been a discarded doll or a mannequin, but as we already know, it's never a mannequin. It turned out to be the body of 16-year-old Pauline Floyd. The young woman had a visible head wound, and a medical examination would determine that she had been strangled to death. The body of Geraldine Hughes, also 16, was found about 150 feet or 45 meters away from Pauline. She had also been strangled to death and both showed signs of sexual assault. Evidence at the scene showed that Geraldine had tried to escape her attacker and had almost made it to the road before being caught and dragged back into the woods. Geraldine and Pauline were best friends living in South Wales, not far from the steel town of Port Talbot. Geraldine and Pauline were both known to be happy and outgoing young women. They both worked at a sewing factory, making £16 a week. On Saturday, September 15th, the two had gone out to a nightclub called the Top Rank in Swansea. It was a big deal to get dressed up and head into the city for a night out. The young women spent the evening enjoying themselves, and Geraldine's cousin saw them leaving the club at about 1 a.m. At the time, they didn't want to pay for a taxi, so they decided to hitchhike instead. Many people back then felt safe hitchhiking, but it would be the last time the girls would be seen alive. Later that morning, a witness saw both Geraldine and Pauline in the backseat of a small white Austin 1100 with a bushy-haired man at the wheel. The witness said it looked like the women were laughing and having a good time. Another witness said they saw a white Austin 1100 parked in the area with a man inside smoking a cigarette. Despite the authorities stopping and inspecting any light-colored vehicle they came across, they were never able to find the person responsible for the murder. The investigation was massive. Investigators spoke to 35,000 people from all different walks of life. The local steel mill employed 13,000 people, and the annual Neath Great Fair, which was going on at the time, attracted people from all over. On top of that, a major highway, the M4, was in the process of being built, so construction workers from all over the UK were traveling to the area. Contact information was written on note cards and catalogued in boxes. Without computers at the time, keeping the investigation organized was a nearly impossible task. Investigators worked tirelessly to sift through all of the information, continuing to interview anybody who could fit the description of the man seen in the car. One person who did, who also owned a white Austin 1100, was a nightclub bouncer named Joe Cappin. Joe was born in 1941, one of seven children. After his parents divorced, his mother remarried and he ended up living in Port Talbot. Joe started getting into trouble at a young age. Starting at 12 years old, he was being arrested for car theft, robbing gas meters, burglary, and assault. By the time he was an adult, he'd been in and out of prison a number of times and could barely hold down a job. He regularly worked as a truck driver or a bouncer, but other times he'd sign up for benefits and then make extra cash under the table. Joe married Christine Powell in 1963 after she got pregnant with their first child. 10 days after the wedding, Joe got sent to prison for 3 years for breaking into houses and robbing gas meters. In 1965, Joe was allowed out for the day to attend his father's funeral, and on his day of freedom, he had sex with Christine, which made them a second child. When he was finally released, he had two kids he had never met. The following year, the couple had child number three. They got by on Joe's sporadic jobs and social benefits for the most part. Joe was constantly in and out of prison for robbery, and the marriage was violent, to say the least. Despite Joe fitting the bill, he told detectives that he had been home the evening of Geraldine and Pauline's murders, and Christine backed up his story. He also claimed that his car, a white Austin 1100, couldn't have been driven as it was up on blocks with the wheels removed at the time. With an alibi that was corroborated by his wife, the investigators marked him off their list and a prime suspect never materialized. Sandra and Geraldine and Pauline's crime scenes were only 7 miles or 11 kilometers apart, and due to the similar circumstances of both attacks, authorities did consider that they were dealing with the same killer for both cases. The problem was that they already set their sights on Sandra's boyfriend for her murder, someone who had no connection to the other two young women. After all, he was the last person to see her, and he admitted to having sex with her before they parted ways. On top of that, some of her blood was found on his shirt, but he told investigators that it had gotten there when they had sex because Sandra was on her period at the time. Despite the circumstantial evidence against him, he maintained his innocence throughout his interrogation. There wasn't enough to charge him, but authorities continued to be suspicious of Sandra's boyfriend, and the two cases continued to be investigated separately. After years with no progress, the cases went cold and were put into storage. On the third anniversary of the murders, Geraldine Hughes' mother organized a march of 50 women from the sewing factory to 10 Downing Street in London. Just in case you aren't aware, that's where the UK's Prime Minister lives. The group held signs that read, "Bring back hanging," and the grieving mother brought with her a petition which had been signed by 9,000 people. She said, quote, "I can't accept what happened to Geraldine. It has left me very bitter. If they ever catch the person responsible, they should hang him. I want him to feel a rope around his neck like the girls felt." Even if the leaders of the UK were willing to reinstate that particular method of execution, there was nobody to hang and Mrs. Hughes' demands fell on deaf ears. In 1998, 25 years after the murders, advances in forensic technology enabled investigators to isolate a DNA sample from fluids found on Geraldine and Pauline's underwear. At the time, the DNA was a mix of both the women's DNA and the killer's, but after months of work, they were able to separate the profiles and put the killers into the DNA database. If the man who had murdered Geraldine and Pauline had been arrested in the decades since, then it was likely he would be in the system. Unfortunately, there were no matches. Investigators didn't give up, though. A team was assembled, led by Chief Inspector Paul Bethel, and they set up in an old, unused police station in the village of Pontydawy. The team was going to start asking suspects for a DNA sample, but they didn't have nearly enough swabs to get a sample from the 35,000 people interviewed during the initial investigation. I'm sure they also didn't have that kind of time. Instead, the investigators dug into the case files, which were now moldy and had been chewed on by rodents. They inspected every document until they narrowed those people down to just 500 that were the most likely suspects. 500 is the amount of swabs they were given to work with. Obviously, suspects were prioritized by criminal records, especially violent crime and most importantly, sexual assault. At the same time, a sample of fluid on Sandra's underwear was also tested and it came back with three separate DNA profiles. When they were separated, they belonged to Sandra and her boyfriend, which was not a surprise since the young man had admitted to engaging in intercourse with his girlfriend that evening. The third profile was of an unknown male. Well, unknown as far as his identity, but well known to the investigator of Geraldine and Pauline's case. It was a match for the DNA from their killer, something that finally solidified the connection between the two cases and officially cleared Sandra's boyfriend once and for all. Once the 500 names were selected, the investigators went about the arduous task of tracking down everybody on the list. Some had died and others had moved away. They got a DNA sample from a man who had emigrated to New Zealand, but he wasn't a match to the killer. One of the men on the list was Joe Kappen, the nightclub bouncer who had been interviewed during the original investigation. When they arrived at the address listed, his now ex-wife Christine informed the investigators that Joe had died of cancer 12 years earlier. He was one of many suspects that were no longer available to request a DNA sample from. After testing 353 men, all of whom willingly provided a sample, and coming up with no match, the team decided to try something new. By that time, familial DNA was becoming a more popular tool for murder investigations, and it was likely that the killer had a child at some point in their life. The team thought it was possible that someone who was raised by a violent predator may have had challenges in life that had also put them on the wrong side of the law. If they ran the killer's DNA in the database for partial matches, they might get a hit and that person might be related to the killer. So that's what they did, and since the technology of the time was much more limited than it is today, the list was quite extensive. The investigators were given a list of 22,000 names and they painstakingly went line by line, crossing them off the list. Eventually, they were left with 100 names that had a DNA profile close enough to be a possible relative of the killer. Within those 100 names was a car thief named Paul Kappen. He would have been 7 years old when the murders were committed, and he was the only person with a parent on the original list of suspects in the case. Detectives were able to get a DNA sample from both Christine and one of Paul's sisters, and with that, they were able to remove Christine's DNA from both Paul and his sister's DNA, and it was an even closer match to the killer. The investigators believed that Joe Kappen was the killer, and the only thing they had left to do was to exhume Joe's body and get a direct DNA sample. Now, I wouldn't say an exhumation is common, but you do hear about them in cases all the time. In the UK, however, it had never been done. This would be the first criminal exhumation in the history of the country. Digging up someone's buried loved one is not something that should be done lightly, and the investigators weren't sure if they would even get permission to do it. Then the investigators found a ticket from a police officer who had stopped Joe in his car during the time he had claimed his vehicle was up on blocks. So, with evidence that Joe had lied, investigators got permission to exhume his body and verify that he was the man who had killed three young women in 1973. On May 15, 2002, a team of forensic archaeologists dug up the grave, which was a family grave Joe shared with two other people, and they collected a DNA sample. It was no surprise when it came back a match to the DNA found on Sandra, Geraldine, and Pauline's remains. Though they had finally identified the killer, there would be no justice for Sandra, Geraldine, and Pauline's families. Joe had lived out his days and died before he could be punished for his heinous crimes. Unfortunately, some of that can be blamed on the investigators who spoke to him during the original investigation. When they spoke to Joe, his vehicle was up on blocks and the tires were off. But that interview had taken place almost a month after Geraldine and Pauline's murders. It's believed that he was changing the tires out because a newspaper had reported that investigators had found tire tracks at one of the scenes. Investigators just took Joe at his word and never followed up to see if he might have been lying. If they had, they may have found the stop and check ticket that the officer had put in the logbooks. They may have caught him earlier and he could have at least served some time for the murders. There's also the question as to whether those were the only three victims of Joe Kappen over the years. His DNA is in the system now, so he should come up if any of his DNA is found in an unsolved case, and that hasn't happened. But what if there wasn't DNA on the victim, or if the victim's remains have never been found? Most people don't believe that a sexually motivated serial killer would suddenly stop and never commit another murder for 17 years until his death. In February of 1973, a man whose description matched Joe Kappen driving a white Austin picked up two hitchhikers near Neath. Instead of dropping them off at their desired location, he took them to a secluded area and attacked them. When they tried to get out of the car, the doors wouldn't open from the inside. But fortunately, the woman in the backseat was able to use her fingernails to pull up the locking mechanism of the back door. She then opened the front door from the outside and the girls were able to escape. Their screaming alerted the residents of a house nearby, and when their lights came on, the assailant fled the scene. One of the girls was scared of getting in trouble with her father, so she didn't report the assault right away. Investigators have compiled that story into a list of other cases of assault and of unsolved murders that fit Joe's MO, but it's unlikely we'll ever get an absolute confirmation in those cases. Though we'll never know for sure the true reach of a monster like Joe Kappen, at least we know for sure that he is in the ground and will never hurt anybody else again. If you're the victim of domestic abuse, please reach out to someone for help. Please talk to your local shelter or call the National Domestic Abuse Hotline at 1-800-799-SAFE. That's 1-800-799-7233. Or you can go to thehotline.org to chat with someone online. This website is set up so that, at any time, hitting the escape key twice will take you to a Google search page. That way, if your abuser is nearby, you won't get caught seeking help. If you're having feelings of harming yourself or someone else, or even just need someone to talk to, please contact your local mental health facility. Call 911 or call the National Suicide Prevention Hotline by simply dialing 988 in the United States. They're available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and will talk to you about any mental health issue you may be facing. If you are a member of the LGBTQ+ community and suffering from discrimination, depression, or are in need of any support, please contact the LGBT National Hotline at 1-888-843-4564 or go to lgbthotline.org. Thanks so much for letting me tell you this story. If you enjoyed it, subscribe on whatever platform you're on, hit like, rate us, or leave us a comment. You can check out our other show, Somewhere Sinister, on YouTube or anywhere you listen to podcasts. If you'd like to support the show, check out our merchandise at thisismonsters.com. The link is in the description. Thanks again, and be safe.